Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera, National Theater Live, and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.
David Sterrett is the editor-in-chief of the Quarterly Review of Film and Video, contributing writer at Cineast, film professor at the Maryland Institute College of Art, and Robin Hood Radio's very own critic. He joins us weekly. The films are 9 Days, The Boy Behind the Door, and Roadrunner, a film about Anthony Bourdain. How are you?
Doing okay, Jill. How about yourself?
Won't complain, but that's my latest policy.
Good, good, good. Well, I am talking to you this time from the wilds of Vermont, where we are away for a week or two, and I nonetheless have some movies to talk about, believe it or not. So let's get into it. The first one I would like to discuss a little bit is called 9 Days, and this is a first feature film by Edson Oda. It is a very unusual movie, and a lot of people have really raved about it, and people are saying that it's all about it tells you the meaning of life, and one reviewer said it invites you to consider your entire worldview. Well, let's just say I didn't respond to it all that strongly. In fact, I'm sort of on the naysayer side of this movie. Not everybody loves it, but a lot of people who love it seem to really regard it as a life-changing experience. Not me, I'm afraid. It has a very interesting premise, and I have to give it points for a certain kind of audacity, because it really does have a kind of a setup that I don't think I've ever quite run across before. Here where we are, we're in a house in the middle of nowhere, on the edge of some sort of desert, or in the middle maybe of some sort of desert, and there is a man there named Will, and he has a very interesting job. The first thing we see him doing is monitoring a whole bank of TV monitors. He's got a wall, which is just one TV screen after another. Not all that many, maybe 2 or 3 dozen of them, and they're all showing different people's lives, ordinary things happening, and he's watching them, and he's sort of keeping track of them. And one that he has particular interest in is a young woman musician, and she is about to play a concerto, and it's going to be a very important moment in her life. And we might think she's going to be a main character of the movie. Then we find out that he's got, like, when we sort of zero in on her TV screen, he's got footage of her from all different periods, from infancy all the way up through her schooling. So it's a very strange sort of bank of TV monitors here. We're not just watching TV shows. And then something happens and this is the very beginning of the movie, on the very verge of her being about to go and play in the great concerto that she's going to do, she dies in a car accident, and apparently it looks like a suicide. And he is very troubled by this. What has happened? Well, then gradually we start to get the backstory here, and we find out what this guy Will, what his job really is. He is somebody who interviews souls who want to be born into the world. And this, it turns out that before we were born, apparently, each one of us went through an interview process when we were still an unborn soul. And then he chooses which ones will actually end up getting to be born. But these people, when they show up at his door, they're like, they look and sound and seem in every way like totally ordinary adults. They just don't have any past. He asks one of them, "When did you learn how to speak?" And the person, "I don't know. I just think I always could." So we have these people, and they turn out to be unborn souls, and it's going to happen over a period of 9 days. He's going to interview these people, and then at the end of that time, he will select one of these souls to be born. And that's what he's monitoring on his TV screens, is people who he selected in the past and what's happened to their lives and whether they've been successful or not. And that's why he's so troubled by one of the souls that he selected, that he auditioned, that he put through the process, has now come to a terrible end, and that bothers him a lot. But most of the movie is taken up with his interviews of several of these souls who show up, these people who show up and want to interview to be born into the world. And the movie, therefore has only one real main character, that is Will, although he also has a good friend who comes by a number of times and sort of helps him out a little bit. But we're always jumping from one of these interviews to another, and the discussions that he has and the conversations that he has and the very challenging questions that he puts to them. What would you do in this kind of situation? What would you do in that kind of situation? And he's not looking for right or wrong answers. He's just sort of seeming to want to get a sense of the basic fundamental character of each one of these souls that might become a potential human being. So again, a very unusual premise, a very offbeat premise. I give Edson Oda a lot of credit for coming up with something pretty original. The thing that bothered me about it is that even though it was not exactly sentimental, it tended to get very new agey and very sort of uplifty. And it all wants to have, even though it has some of the people have cynical points of view on life, and certainly he's got to turn down most of these souls. They're not going to make the grade. So in a way, you know, it's not a sunshiny and cloying movie, but I just found the whole thing just a little bit too, it verged on platitude really a lot of the time. And just too much of it was the sort of life wisdom that's just all too easy to think about and to think gives the answer to everything. And I just felt that the movie fell prey to a kind of simplistic quality, which was not in the premise, but was in the way the premise was worked out. A lot of people are loving this movie. As I said, it seems to be very popular. It's playing in theaters, which is kind of a distinction nowadays. And I certainly don't want to discourage people from seeing it. But after a while, I found it's about 2 hours long. I found it went on way, way longer than I could stay interested in it. Our second film for today could not be more different. The Boy Behind the Door. This is a movie made by a team of filmmakers, David Charbonnier and Justin Powell, and it is a suspense movie, a horror movie, and a really harrowing one. And why I like The Boy Behind the Door is, if you can take it, because it's very intense and it's about children in danger throughout, that is what it is about, it's really well done. I just found it as not just filmmaking craft, but real sort of edge of your seat stuff. I found it really, really effective. And it's streaming. It's very easy to find on Shudder, and I'm sure elsewhere as well. So here's what happens. Right at the very first seconds of the movie, we have these two boys. They're about 12 years old, Bobby and Kevin, and they are kidnapped and they are shoved into the trunk of a car by an unknown assailant or assailants. And the next thing you know, we have a little flashback and we see what happy boys they were and how they played together. One of them, by the way, is black. The other one is mixed race. So we have a little bit of that sort of racial balancing, but it's very nicely done in this movie. And they are having a nice time playing with each other and having a great time and swearing to be friends forever. No matter what, they will always be friends. And then the horrible kidnapping happens. Well, as it turns out, one of the boys ends up in the house of horror. The other boy is left for dead in the trunk of that car. But it turns out he's not dead, and he manages to get out of the trunk of the car, and he manages to get out of the garage, and he manages to get into the house where his friend is being held. And then what I would have said was, run away, find somebody to help, get the cops or something. But he is such an enterprising 12-year-old, and he really believes in his pledge to be friends forever with his buddy, that he decides he's going to go into the house and try to rescue his friend. Not maybe a very intelligent decision. And the one flaw with The Boy Behind the Door is, from time to time, we really do have boys, even 12-year-old boys, should know a little bit better, should have a little bit better judgment to then let this particular part of their horrifying situation get even more horrifying. Just for one example, the boy who is being held is Kevin, and it's Bobby who is trying to save Kevin. And at one point, Bobby is on the phone with the cops. He actually managed to get the cops on a phone, on an old-fashioned rotary dial phone yet. So there he is. And then they say, stay on the phone. We've almost got your location. Stay on the phone. And then he hears somebody coming. He says, I have to run. And he hangs up the phone. So, I mean, that's like really dumb. Then again, I could see myself doing something as really dumb as that in a situation that stressful, and he is only a 12-year-old boy. Anyway, a few moments like that in the film aside, the movie is pretty much perfect in what it sets out to do. So again, what we have in this movie is these two 12-year-old boys in horrible danger. We don't know why they've been kidnapped. We don't know who kidnapped them. We have no idea what's going on. Little by little, these things become clear. Eventually, we do discover who the kidnappers are, nothing about their lives, but why they did this. And it turns out to be a really horrifying thing in itself. Mostly, though, we see these two boys in the Kevin being held captive and just all kinds of awful things, and Bobby really, really, really very ingeniously working to save him. It's what I sometimes call sort of minimalist horror, which is something that we've had a fair amount of this season. And it's interesting because you have a very, very small number of characters, and there's not much for the filmmakers to work with here, so they have to do everything they can with the few characters they have. Also, very few settings in this movie. Mostly, we're in this terrible house where Bobby is being held kidnapped. Excuse me, Kevin is being held kidnapped, and Bobby is trying to rescue him. So, again, a very limited settings, very limited characters, but a lot is done with those things. It's kind of like, I always think of old rock and roll in these terms back when I was a kid in the 50s. You had 3 minutes, and you had three chords, and what could you do with those ingredients? So here again, we have a handful of characters, one or two locations, and what can you do with those ingredients? And I think that the filmmakers, Charbonnier and Powell, have done a marvelous job with it. It's really, really a well-done thriller. If you can take a very intensive thriller about kids in danger, then by all means, check out The Boy Behind the Door. Our final film today, again, very different from the other two, is a documentary, Roadrunner, a film about Anthony Bourdain, the celebrity chef. And this was made by Morgan Neville, who's a good documentary maker, very, very prolific, does all kinds of work. Among his movies that are memorable, 20 Feet from Stardom, very good, but Best of Enemies, Buckley versus Vidal, a really, really excellent documentary. So Morgan Neville does good work as a documentary specialist. Roadrunner is exactly what it says it is. It is a film about Anthony Bourdain, the celebrity chef. And the movie chronicles his career and his life and gets into those things quite interestingly. Bourdain was just an ordinary, very low-level guy on the sort of the kitchen circuit. And then he wrote a book called Kitchen Confidential. And he sort of ripped the lid off the cooking business. And it made him into a big star and a controversial star because he revealed all kinds of secrets about the chef's game. And then he was able to parlay that into a TV show called A Cook's Tour, which started as another book he was going to write, but then it turned into a TV show where he traveled the world and he sampled exotic cuisines and met exotic people and went to exotic places. And that's what A Cook's Tour was all about. And that was what really made him into a big, very, very widely known celebrity chef. Along the way, all kinds of other things happened in his life, though. For example, he became a heroin addict. Very, very much into drugs and alcohol. And the movie, you know, does not shy away from that. It's very much in there. Bourdain was also, he was a real macho character. He had this real sort of super masculine, and I would say in a lot of ways, toxically masculine idea of what it meant to be a chef and what it meant to be a star and all of that. And that's all in the movie, too. The movie doesn't gloss over any of that. Now, of course, what people know about Anthony Bourdain, and we certainly find this out in the movie, is that his life did not end happily. He killed himself when he was only 61 years old, and that was about 3 years ago from now. So this movie is all very posthumous in getting into his life after his life is over. The movie seems to suggest that his girlfriend in that late stage of his life, Assia Argento, played a part in his sort of self-destructive impulses. And I think the movie sort of suggests that she was unfaithful to him and it made him very unhappy and so forth and so on. And, you know, he finds out about things that she's doing in the tabloids and whatnot. But it really seems that Bourdain had a deeply self-destructive streak for a very long time. The drugs were a part of that. The alcohol was a part of that. And then late in the movie, he says, oh, yeah, he often thought about killing himself. And sometimes we even hear him speaking about it. There's a lot of footage of him that the movie has at its disposal because he was a very public personality for so many years. So anyway, the movie sort of suggests and dances around some of the reasons why he might have committed suicide. I think that probably, again, he had a self-destructive streak. And it was something much more complicated and deeply rooted than any, you know, 2-hour documentary can really get into, but the movie is interesting on that, as in so many other things. Now, the movie Roadrunner has been controversial in movie circles, partly because it fakes Anthony Bourdain's voice. Yes, there's enormous amount of just a amounts of footage of him, and it uses a whole lot of that, and we see him and hear him speaking in his own voice. But there are times when it's voiceover narration, and the guy is dead, and he's sort of talking about things as if he were still alive. And it's they used sort of artificial means to simulate his voice and do their own narration in his words, and this has been very controversial. I don't think it's such a terrible thing for Morgan Neville and the other filmmakers to have done, because we all know that movies are full of trickery and fakery and stuff like that, and it does appear to be at least Anthony Bourdain's own words, even if they're not spoken in his own voice. So the movie is a little bit of a fake in that regard. But mostly, it's an interesting, lively documentary. I was never, and still am not, all that interested in Anthony Bourdain, but he was a very interesting personality, and again, the movie does not in any way whitewash the darker sides of his personality and of his character and of the things that he did. And I found it what appears to be a fairly well-rounded portrait of a very complex, intricate, and ultimately very troubled person. So if you want to see a really interesting documentary about a recent figure in popular culture who had a very complex and troubled life, then Roadrunner, a film about Anthony Bourdain, is the film for you. And so that is my somewhat jumping all over the place story this week, Jill.
But what a good job jumping you did. Thank you very much, David Sterrett. Films in Focus, the films 9 Days, The Boy Behind the Door, and Roadrunner, a film about Anthony Bourdain.